We know the joy of giving is its own reward. But who says you can't get something for yourself, too? Now when you buy vanilla Visa gift cards, you can enter to win one of over 10 prizes every week for 10 weeks, including a grand prize of $10,000 in vanilla gift cards. So get gifting and start sharing the delight for more chances to win. Go to get-gifting.com to learn more and enter for your chance to win. Cards are issued by the Bancorp Bank, MetaBank, and Sutton Bank, members FDIC, pursuant to a license from Visa USA, Inc., and may be used in the U.S. everywhere Visa debit cards are accepted. Terms and conditions apply. Cards distributed and serviced by Income Financial Services, Inc., which is licensed as a money transmitter by the New York State Department of Financial Services. NMLS ID number 912772.
Welcome to the next episode of Palisades Podcast. I'm Steve Crone.
And I'm Brooke Dougherty.
Still, as always.
Still.
And one of the nice things about doing these podcasts is that we sometimes get to know people we've never met before, and sometimes we get to talk with people we've known for many, many years and get to know them in a different way. And today we are honored to have Rabbi Stephen Carr Rubin, the Rabbi Emeritus of Kehillat Israel Synagogue in Pacific Palisades, who is in the category of people that I've known for a long time, like about 30
years. It makes me a has-been, doesn't it?
Instantly? It is sort of.
And was the host of the event that was the inspiration for this podcast. Remember when we did Busted and we taped it at the synagogue, remember?
Yes.
Busted 101?
Stephen, you remember.
We had at the synagogue, we had Steve and we had some stand-up comedians and we had high school kids and an audience full of high school
and
kids.
And we had a judge and we had some police
and a probation
officers.
Officer.
Oh, yeah.
And you were the moderator. But
he said a welcome.
Yeah.
And then left.
Anyway.
I said a brilliant welcome.
Dementia starts to set in.
Instantly.
Anyway, as I was saying before we were interrupted.
What was I doing this morning? I don't remember.
You probably had breakfast at some point.
No, I skipped breakfast.
Maybe that was yesterday. In any event, Stephen is in the category of people that I've known for 35 years, and Brooke's known him for a long time, too. So, welcome.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
Well, we're glad to have you. So, as we often do, we'd first like to find out a little bit about you, and the nice thing for us is to find out things that, although I've known you for a long time, probably didn't really know before. So, tell us a little bit about where you started, where you came from, and then we'll get into how you got here and where you're going next.
I was born at a very early age.
No.
Yeah. I was actually born 10 minutes from here at St. John's Hospital in beautiful downtown Santa Monica, California, and lived in Santa Monica until I was 16, went to public school. And
Sam Ojai?
Went to Sam Ojai for 1 year in 10th grade, and then my family picked up and moved to Sacramento.
That was harsh.
So right in the middle of high school, I moved to Sacramento.
And that explains a lot.
It does.
You had friends.
Although,
and you had none.
One of the highlights of my young life, I've been a drummer like my whole life since I was a little kid. And that 1 year at Sam Ojai, I got drafted to be the drummer. And they had this big stage band, the Sam Ojai Serenaders. And the night before I moved to Sacramento, we played in the Hollywood Bowl. So that was like one of the highlights of my life was,
and then it was
16 and it was
goodbye.
All downhill from there. And then the next day we literally moved, got in the car and drove to Sacramento. But here's the cool thing about that, that I always remember. I remember being in the car, literally driving with my family up to move to Sacramento. And I remembered thinking, gee, I'm about to go somewhere where nobody knows me. And how cool is that? I can be anybody I want to be. I have no past, you know, whatever the foibles of my past are and whatever image I've created in people, I can leave it all behind and start all over again and be whoever I imagine myself to be. That was kind of a cool, actually, revelation about that lasted really my whole life.
Who did you decide to be?
he decided to be Steve Crone.
This is the same guy.
Achieve imitation.
I thought I'd be much cooler when I arrived in Sacramento. I don't think I was, frankly, but, you know, attitude's everything. So I felt more empowered to when I showed up in Sacramento at in the 11th grade than I had in the past. I was a very small kid, you know, physically. I'm like 5'10", But when I was always the shortest kid in my class, all the way up to like the 11th grade, and so I always had a kind of an attitude, a perspective on life that I was small and relatively vulnerable, and I wasn't a good athlete. And
so you had to somehow stick out, make a name for yourself, do something.
So drums was one of the ways I did that. Music was a way for
me. Were you in a band in Sacramento?
I was in like a million things. I started actually playing professionally when I was 16 in Sacramento, only because the first two things I did when I got to Sacramento, one, I joined the synagogue youth group. We joined a synagogue because we'd always been very synagogue connected. And second was I found
Reform.
Reform. And second was I found a drum teacher. And the drum teacher that I found at the time, this sort of wild and crazy guy named Stanley Linetta, just died actually last year, was the drummer and percussionist of everything in Sacramento. He was the percussion, the timpanist in the Sacramento Symphony, and he played all the musicals, and he played everywhere. So I started taking lessons with him, and the New Year's Eve of the first year I was there, he said, "Oh, I have a job for you." I said, "What do you mean you have a job?" "Yeah, you know, I get lots of jobs and I can only do one. So you're going to go play with Fory Long's big band." And I said, okay, because he figured I was good enough. And from then on, I would get all these jobs. I started working on weekends and playing casuals and playing professionally. So it was great for my sense of self-worth.
What did your dad do? Why were you in
Sacramento? My father worked for the state of California. He was a division of highways.
Which dad are you talking about?
My second father, my biological father, died when I was 38 and I was 4. And then my mother remarried to my current father, whose 96th birthday is this week, as a matter of fact. And he worked for the state of California Division of Highways. He was a right-of-way agent and things like that. And then we moved to Sacramento because he got a promotion to become responsible for land acquisition for all the freeways in Northern California. And so Sacramento being the capital, that was where the main office of the...
Did you like Sacramento?
I actually loved Sacramento. It was interesting. I was freaking out about moving, obviously. I had friends, here. And
the beach isn't very good
and,
up there.
Yeah, the beach is not so hot. And but, you know, it was interesting that when I moved to Sacramento, it's kind of an interesting psychological study, because what I liked about Sacramento was it was small. Was small enough that I could picture all of it. You know, I could picture the city once I got to know it in my mind, which I could never do in L.A. L.A. was just this endless, boundaryless sprawl. And something about having a sense of boundaries in my head in Sacramento made me feel sort of somehow emotionally more secure. I mean, I'm sure there's a deep psychological issue there. But so it was great for me. And it was... small enough town that I became a kind of a big fish in a small town. Within a year after I got there, I was playing percussion in the Sacramento Symphony, and the next year I was principal percussionist of the Sacramento Symphony at 17. I was the youngest, and I had all these things that really... I was president of their youth group the year after I got there in the synagogue, and I...
And such a small town, you probably made it in the local papers all the time.
Yeah, so I was like some, you know, I was a high school celebrity kind of thing, at least in my little community. So it was, you know, it was good for my sense of self-worth and value, and loved that. So.
And then what happened?
Yeah, really.
No, I mean, I don't mean that.
Oh, that's not what you meant.
How did you go downhill so quickly over the last 50 years? Yes,
how the mighty have fallen. Yeah.
No, so first of all, before we talk about... what's happened next? What was the Jewish community like in Sacramento? I mean, it doesn't strike me as a hotbed of Judaism that's going to spawn Jewish leaders.
No, it was, well, you know, the Jewish community was relatively small. There were two synagogues, a Reform synagogue and a Conservative synagogue. And we became very active in the Reform synagogue. And all of that was a good experience for me. I mean, the youth group was the source of my friendships there, and I started volunteering and sort of teaching, and I never really thought about becoming a rabbi, which is what I ended up doing, but I liked the Jewish
stuff. No, what you ended
stuff.
Up doing is coming to our podcast.
Well, that's true.
In between, there was the rabbinical part, but anyway.
It was a side trip for a
this
while.
This is the pinnacle. That was the lead-up.
This is the height of my career right now.
I know that.
It's That's a sad commentary, isn't it?
It's the height of my career, too.
It's a mutually sad commentary. Yeah. Anyway, so the Jewish community was, but it was very active. I mean, as a community, there were, you know, the synagogue did lots of communal interfaith work, and they were involved in helping homelessness. And it was an opportunity for me to get involved in sort of the community through the synagogue in ways that seemed meaningful to me.
So looking back at that time period, did you see the genesis of your thinking about becoming a rabbi, or is that something that later?
Not really. You know, I mean, my synagogue associations were positive, so that was certainly a part of it. And, you know, actually, I think, back to the psychology of it, when I think about before I moved to Sacramento, when I was really a little kid, I used to go to the synagogue, like when I had Sunday school, I would go early and hang out with the maintenance guys and, you know, polish silver and do things, because I think part of my compensation for the trauma of my father dying when I was very young and all of the upheaval that happened as a result was that something about Judaism being so old, you know, thousands of years old, and the synagogue is symbolizing this very ancient, rooted civilization was a positive thing for me. It gave me a sense of foundation and a sense of belonging that was very helpful throughout my life. And I'm sure that was part of what ended up, you know, turning me into the rabbinate. But really, it was my junior year of college. I wanted to go study abroad. So I was going to UC Davis at the time, and the UC campuses have all these, you know, education abroad programs all over the world. So I thought I would go to Paris. That seemed like a cool place. And I had been studying French, but I was terrible in languages, and my French wasn't good enough, so they wouldn't take me. But at the time, you could go to Israel and not have to speak the language because their one-year program was in English, even though it was in Israel. So I said, okay, I'll go to Israel. So I went to Israel my junior year.
And that's as much thought as you gave it. It wasn't like I'm going to meet my people.
No, it was like
learn about my heritage.
No, I want to go abroad and I can go. One of my sisters had just spent the year in Israel, so that was part of the, I was connected that in that way. But it was either Israel, England, or Japan. Those were the three campuses where you could speak English. You didn't have to know the native language. And I did know the native language, obviously, in England, so sort of. So I thought, opportunity, I'll go to Israel and see what it's like. So I went, spent the year in Jerusalem at the Hebrew University, and I spent most of the time studying sort of Judaic studies things, Jewish texts, because it was an opportunity.
Jewish
there.
Girls probably,
and
too.
Jewish girls, and yeah, who some of whom actually are still friends. I'm still friends with one of them. Just called me today from that year. It was a great year. It was a powerful year, and really the idea of enjoying the study of Jewish tradition and texts and things was an important part of what I learned from that year. And then when I came back, I don't know many rabbis who admit this, but when I came back and was about to graduate from college, the Vietnam War was still going on.
What year was that you were ready to graduate?
It was 1971. And I had a lottery number of 77.
Which means you were getting taken.
That means SOL. And I got classified 1A, and I got sent a draft notice to be drafted into the Army to go to Vietnam. And I was freaking out because it was the last thing I wanted to do.
Yes.
And so that year, one of the things I got a lawyer. I was trying to figure out how to get out of being drafted.
I did the same thing.
And going to Vietnam. I got sent down for my physical. I passed my physical.
Where did you take it? In Oakland?
In Oakland, yeah. And but I figured out that if I could get into rabbinical school, I could get a deferment.
Whoa.
They had what was called a 4D deferment for people in seminaries, Jewish or Christian or whatever.
So God got you out of the war.
And since I was interested and I really had enjoyed studying the text anyway, I hustled and did whatever I needed to do and managed to get into the Hebrew Union College. And then I could breathe a sigh of relief and not be drafted and have 5 years of rabbinical school to figure out, A, what I wanted to do with my life, and B, to study things that I already knew I liked studying because I'd been doing it the year before. So, you know, that was the attraction. But it was never, I want to be a rabbi. You know, that wasn't why I went to rabbinic school.
So wait, so you went to Israel for your junior year?
Junior year of college, yeah.
And then the draft thing happened when you were a senior?
Yeah, during my senior year I was getting, and so the minute I was graduating, I was going to be drafted. In fact, the only reason that literally didn't happen was because Congress and the president that year were having a fight, and there was a month when nobody got drafted because the draft law had expired, and the president was holding it hostage for some kind of whatever political thing. And in that time, I started rabbinic school.
So, I've always found it interesting to look at tragic situations and see how some people benefit.
Yeah.
You know, like from 9/11, there are people who somehow benefited. If they owned a security company, their company became more valuable or things like that. But you benefited from the Vietnam War. You got a career out of it.
Well, you know, it's like life is filled with, I often have this conversation with people, life is filled with blessings and curses. And one of the great challenges of life is you're not always sure which is which. And the things that sometimes look like blessings turn into the curses, and the things that look like curses turn into the blessings. And most people I know have experiences of something bad at the time that happened to them, losing a relationship, losing a job, whatever, that because of a combination of them and timing and all kinds of things, they turned into a positive in their life. And that certainly happened with me out of that panic of being drafted into the Vietnam War. So then I went to 5 years of rabbinic school. And
where was that, New York?
It's 1 year in Jerusalem. I went back to Jerusalem for a year, and then 3 years in Los Angeles, and my final year in New York. I was ordained in New York. And because I really had no interest in going into a congregation, it seemed like a really crazy job for someone to be working 24/7 and have thousands of bosses and things like that. I was interested in education, so I got a master's in education from USC while I was going to the Hebrew Union College because it was across the street. It seemed like it'd be an easy thing to do. And figured I would do something in education. And when I was ordained as a rabbi, my first job was the National Associate Director of Education for the Reform Movement in their national office in New York. So I did that for 4 years.
Did you have family in New York?
I didn't have any family in New York. My mother was born in Flint. My biological father was born in Flint. Also, his family, mostly their families, were out here. My second father was born in Ohio, but really had no family. So there really wasn't anybody.
So you went back and lived in New York
on
your own.
I went back to New York on my own. It was like going to a foreign country where they kind of speak English. It was really different culturally to be in New York. And the difference between California and New York was so dramatic for me. They're so much more traditional and what you close your wear and everything at the time.
Yeah, they have rules back there.
Yes. And
like you don't wear white after Labor Day.
Yes, they have. It's like they right? have, it's such a different environment. But mostly the reason I ended up, it's another reason I ended up in as a congregational rabbi was because I grew up in L.A. I don't do weather. You know, it's like when you grow up in Los Angeles, you don't even think about weather. It's just not a factor in your life.
You think about traffic, but not weather.
You think about traffic. You don't think about weather. Right. There I'm in New York where they have like weather, you know, snow and
winter.
Winter. And first of all, winter's terrible and summer's terrible.
Terrible too.
So, you know, there's 2 months that are good and otherwise it sucks. So 5 years of being in New York was long enough. And I said, it's time to get out of here. And I was married to my first wife at the time, who, by the way, grew up in Pacific Palisades, my first wife, Darlene.
Wow.
She grew up in Pacific Palisades.
You still in touch with her?
And not really. We're Facebook friends. Okay. But I did marry her to her current husband. So I did their wedding.
Okay.
Yeah, so we were in good terms.
Yeah.
And not only that, but her family were founders of KI.
Original founders.
Yes, they were among the original. In fact, the first services were in their home over on La Cumbre. Yeah, it's like crazy. And we had our relationship.
You didn't know that.
Our relationship had nothing to do with this. I was divorced from her and married to Didi for a couple of years before I ended up here. Totally, totally unconnected. It's just that's the way life goes. But she and I both at the time, 5 years, woke up one day and said, time to go back to California. And there had been a rabbi in San Fernando Valley who had been calling me every couple of years and saying, would you like to come work with me? And so as life would have it, the very day that we agreed it's time to move back to California, that rabbi called me and said, "You ready to move back to California?"
And you said,
"And I said, yes. God is calling me to California." I said yes and moved to the
Temple,
valley.
Temple Judea.
Temple Judea. So I went to Temple Judea, where I ended up staying for 6 years
as the associate rabbi.
Yeah, although I was acting senior for basically two of those years.
Well, but the valley does have weather.
Yeah, hot. The valley has hot weather.
Hot weather.
But and that's how I ended up here at KI, because I, in the meantime, had gotten divorced, found the love of my life, Dee Dee, and when I married Dee Dee, she already had Gable, my stepdaughter, who was 2 at the time we met and 4 when we got married. So because of custody issues, I needed to, had to stay in L.A., couldn't move out of L.A., so I stayed at Judea until I could find a another job to have my own congregation in Los Angeles, and eventually KI came up, and it seemed to be a match, and we moved to
hold
the
on,
Palisades.
Hold on, hold on, wait, 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 wait.
Wait, you glossed over that.
The dad of your first wife was one of the founders of the synagogue that you ultimately...
The dad and the mother. Yeah, the parents of
did they,
Cumber.
Were they
their
part,
last name was Cumber, K-U-M-M-E-R.
Were they part of the invitation to become the rabbi there?
No, they weren't even...
No connection.
Her father died long before...
Talk about weird.
But if you look, KI has a book that was published once called The Founding Years, that's got pictures and everything of the founding years. My ex-wife is in it. Her sisters are in it. They're the first confirmation class. They're the first there, because they were literally among the handful of found people who founded the synagogue. And as I said, by the time I got here, we were divorced. I was remarried. I had really nothing to do with it. And they weren't, none of them were connected to the synagogue at all anymore. Just the way life works.
Yeah.
The magic
ahead,
of how life
okay,
works.
So here's my hold on. And you and I talked about this earlier. Tell us how you met your wife, your second wife.
How I met my current
the
love,
good
the
wife.
Love of my life.
The good wife.
No, they were both good.
The better wife.
The Dee Dee. Well, see, Dee Dee was a singer and an entertainer. She had her own TV show. 1 year co-starring in an ABC sitcom, and that was before I knew her, though. But she was been a singer her whole life. And when I was at Judea, she actually was bringing Gable, my daughter, my stepdaughter, to the Mommy and Me program there. And the synagogue was about to celebrate its 30th anniversary with a big dinner dance, and the head of the Mommy and Me program knew that Dee Dee was a singer, and they were looking for to hire an entertainer. So they auditioned. She was singing in a club on Ventura Boulevard, and the head of the preschool came to me and said, "We're going to go audition," because she knew I was a musician. So she said, "We're about to go audition this mother of one of our preschool kids to as a singer. Do you want to come? Will you come with us and listen?" So I said, sure. So I went with the group to audition the singer, who turned out to be Dee Dee Carr. And I was rather smitten by her. She was amazing. And actually, she.
And still are.
And still am. And they told her that, our rabbi's a drummer. So she invited me to come up and sit in, because she figured the worst thing I could do is break the drums. But. But it might help her get a job. So that was fun. So I got to sit in and play drums with her. And then she got the job. And that was like in March. And a couple months later, I asked about, whatever happened with, did we hire her? Because I really wasn't on the hiring committee. I just really went. And they said, yes. And it's a tragic thing. She's separated from her husband and they're getting divorced. And I said, that's terrible. What day of the week did you say she comes here every week? And I started showing up at the Mommy and Me program and schmoozing and becoming friendly, and eventually tricked her into going out with me, because she had no desire to go out with a rabbi.
So you really...
It's not easy to be a rabbi and be dating.
You really didn't use your position...
No, I didn't.
...to
I didn't.
Sexually harass her into going out with you?
No, I didn't. No, it wasn't that at all.
Yeah, nowadays, the rabbi hanging out at the preschool would be like...
Yeah, that alone is
creepy.
That alone is already a problem.
Yeah.
Although I spent a lot of time in the preschool here, I love being with the little kids, and it was always fun. And I would play guitar and sing with them, and I write songs. So I write. I've written a lot of children's songs.
You kind of have to play the guitar to be a member of the clergy these days.
These days,
whatever religion you have to.
Yeah, it's a very popular. It's popular to be a
folk mass,
folkish guitar singing. Well, it's more actually more accessible.
Yeah,
the whole point is to try to connect with people. You know, it's like we live in an era, unlike in the past when people would have altars and bimas and, you know, way up there and everybody else is down here. I mean, like our synagogue is totally designed. Exactly the opposite,
right?
On purpose, because I was there as the rabbi helping sign it, to be about community and connection, and there isn't anybody higher. In fact, it's the opposite. The podium where we are is at the bottom, and everybody else is sort of up, like sort of raked, benches in a sense, because it's a way of connecting with people and creating a sense of intimacy, which is very different than sort of old style religion. But that's sort of late 20th century. Re-envisioning how clergy can make religious experiences more meaningful and personal to people. And that was always, you know, my own need was to connect with people. I don't even like having big podiums in front of me. I'd rather have a music stand because it's small and I feel like I can, you know, touch people.
As you often do, you can walk in front of it.
And I do, and walk in front of it, and then, you know, it's like not have anything between me and others. So, look, being a rabbi has been, it's one of those things you sort of, I fell into in a sense that way. And as soon as I started working at Temple Judea, it was like, oh my God, how did I not know this is what I'm meant to do? It's such an incredible privilege to have a role in life where people, because you have the role, you have the name tag that says, you know, rabbi, they just invite you into these intense, powerful moments in their lives, births and sicknesses and deaths and, you know, and all the celebrations. And it's like, who else gets to do that? You know, and see people at their best and see people wrestling with, you know, their worst instincts and really feel like you make a difference. I mean, that's really the gift of it all, is feeling like something that I say or something that I do might actually matter to somebody. And, you know, most of us do things we do and sort of rarely get feedback on the impact that we make. So for me, it was a constant privilege to be able to feel like something I said, you know, helped somebody, made a difference with somebody.
Wow. Steve, let's take a quick break just so I can thank our sponsors.
Sure.
Okay, so today, a special shout out once again to Anthony Margolis for supporting us every month, and to Trish Bowe at State Farm and Vince over there. Shout out also to new sponsor Vivian from Vivian's Boutique and my other girl clothing supplier, Denise at Boca, without whom I would look like trash most days. Anyway, those ladies are helpful. Steve, did you want to add something?
Yes, I did.
What, Steve?
We also don't want to forget to thank Nicholas Grandchamp.
Oh, at Wells Fargo Bank.
The manager at Wells Fargo Bank, who has graciously allowed us to record our podcasts every week here in his office. He clears out for an hour or so and lets us use his office and his bank, and we appreciate it.
Yeah, I feel like there's somebody else we need to thank. Well, there's Keith from the Good News Radio Show, whose station I really recommend you check out at the Good News.
Okay,
that's it. Let's go back.
Okay, so Steve, we were talking. You were at Judea, and
let's
you're there for
now.
6 years, and then you. How did you come to KI?
Well, as I said, I came to KI because I was desperate to find a...
Be your own man.
Place of my own.
Your own place. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, I need to have a place of my own.
You figured 6 years is enough as a...
Well, you know, it's interesting because I had applied when the previous senior left with some controversy that we just won't go into now because it's not about whatever. At Judea, when the previous senior left there, I applied to be the senior, to get hired as the senior rabbi there. It was a 1,000 family congregation. There were, you know, two rabbis all the time. I was the second rabbi. In fact, he had left on a year sabbatical the year after I got there. So the year after I got there, I was the acting senior for the whole year. And then he came back, and there was this whole controversy, and he left. And I applied for the job, and I didn't get hired as the senior. They didn't want me to leave, but they didn't also want me to be the senior. So they brought in someone who was very different from me, kind of an older guy who had very different approach and attitudes, and it was, and suddenly it was hard for me to be there because he was the senior. I had to do things his way, and it was just not my style. But then because I was married and had this custody thing, I couldn't just leave. So I was there 2 years longer than I wanted to be while I kept looking for a job.
And in Los Angeles.
Los Angeles. So I had applied for another synagogue up the road from Judea that I also didn't get hired in.
You know, John Wooden was the fourth choice for UCLA.
There we go. So
don't feel bad.
Well, it was, you know, rejection was a good lesson. I mean, it was painful. I couldn't believe, who wouldn't want me? I thought to myself, you know, it's like, well, look. And I felt I'd been successful in doing what I'd been doing at Judea. And it was really devastating when I didn't get hired. In either of those places, drove me into therapy, actually. Started talking to someone and go through a lot of self-examination about, you know, who I am and what my strengths are and where does resilience come from and how do you deal with rejection. And so it was very helpful. And the power of attitude, that attitude's everything, which I certainly believe. So I decided that even at Judea, though they didn't hire me, that while I was there, I was going to be the best version of myself that I could possibly be and the best rabbi I could be. And when KI came up, frankly, at the time, I mean, it was a much smaller congregation. It was, you know, a couple hundred families. And I had friends who were rabbis in other communities who were dying to get back to California, who are from here, who wouldn't apply because it had a very bad reputation among rabbis.
Because it was Reconstruction?
No, because it had gone through three rabbis, three cantors, and three educators in the previous 6 years. So it sounded like not a good place to work.
It's a squirrely community. You have to understand it.
So, you know, but I had gone through a lot of stuff at Judea, and by then I felt very confident that, you know, people just need a little attention and that if I had the opportunity to come, it would be fine. And it just, it was one of those things that from the first phone call I got, which was one person on the search committee who called, you know, everybody who applied was assigned a person called. Then I met with two people and then I met with a larger committee. And every single one of those relationships and people that I talked to, excuse me, I really liked. I had an instant affinity to. I had an instant, well, this is like, I love this place. I don't understand what people think poor of it. Everybody I met, I really felt good about. So when I got offered the job, I was thrilled. And became, and then, you know, it just sort of worked. It was one of those communities that that I thought was special and down to earth and unpretentious, certainly at the time, very much so.
Yet filled with a lot of amazingly talented people.
Fabulous.
Not just wealthy, but entrepreneurial, successful, creative, intelligent. Yeah. People that I think this is atypical of communities.
It's a unique kind of place. It's a unique community. It was a remarkable, you know, gathering of people from different walks of life with different talents and abilities. And I kind of grew. I mean, I was in my 30s. I kind of grew along with the congregation. And, you know, having Dee Dee as my partner was a real asset because, I mean, she's a people person. She was an entertainer.
She's a great schmoozer.
Yeah, she says, I went from, you know, showbiz to shulbiz. And it was like, you know, it was like perfect for me because she loves people and loves being involved with people. So, you know, it was like two for the price of one. But it was, I don't know, I just love being here. So.
And as one who was, what year did you start?
86.
Okay, so I joined KI in 83. I wasn't on the search committee, but I was aware of when you started. And you, I would say you cut your own cloth as you became the rabbi and did things the way you wanted to do them, not always the traditional way. And I know you got some flack along the way at various times for doing things
one thing or another.
Yeah, like I'll never forget the Easter wearing Easter bunnies to shul one night for
yes.
something.
Purim, I'm sure.
Yeah, Purim. Yes.
Purim costume. Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. I got flack for all kinds of things.
Right.
I mean, I got flack because interesting enough, because you know, I'd always been ever since I was ordained as a rabbi, which was in 1976. I officiated interfaith marriages.
Right.
Most rabbis didn't. Most rabbis still don't. And all the rabbinic associations had sort of rules against officiating in interfaith marriages, and it never made sense to me, and I've always didn't. The second wedding I did was an interfaith marriage. To me, it always seemed like, A, it's the right thing to do just ethically, and B, that it was good for the Jewish community to be open and non-judgmental and inclusive and welcoming people. And I think that's actually part of the reason the KI grew was because of a very self-aware, self-conscious attitude that I had of being inclusive and non-judgmental about whatever.
And extremely tolerant.
About everybody. So it was a safe place for people, and it was a creative place. And I thought in a dynamic place and lots of things going on all the time. So, you know, I've stuck to that and I was doing.
And you've written a number of books about the subject.
Yeah, I wrote books about interfaith relationships and counseling. And,
mm-hmm.
and so I was very public about it as well. And I was also doing gay, lesbian commitment ceremonies for anybody who...
Before it was legal to marry.
Before it was legal, and,
right.
you know, it's just part of the same approach, and I think that helped, and...
And I remember at least once or twice you giving a sermon on High Holidays about something to do with gay rights or gay marriage
yeah.
or something like that, and KI became known as a place that anybody could come and be a part and be welcomed, and I think a lot of that credit goes to you.
No, thanks, but that was part of the what I thought the synagogue should be like. Anyway, any religious institution should be that. You know, and I got flack for giving a sermon on Yom Kippur about domestic violence in the Jewish community. I did that 25 years ago, and when really nobody was talking about it. And still, it's still what I'm part of what I'm doing now in my retirement is that.
And you've gotten some flack over... some sermons you've given about Israel.
Yeah, and, you know, political positions. I mean, it's not always smart. It's never really smart to talk about politics from the pulpit. But, you know, I have passions and things that I think are ethically based that I think is appropriate to talk about, you know, as a religious leader, as a person in a religious leadership position. So
looking back on, you're now a rabbi emeritus, and we'll talk yes. about in just a minute about what you're doing nowadays. But looking back on your career as, say, the rabbi of KI, what regrets, if any, do you have? Things you did or things you didn't do?
What regrets do I have?
Or maybe things you would have done differently.
I've often felt that I could have been more involved in social justice issues. I've been involved in social justice issues. I created a lot of
Yes, you have.
Tikkun Olam.
Well,
kind
you're
of,
doing that now.
And
so
I'm doing
that's
that
good.
Now. And actually, the thing I'm most probably that. Most proud of in my whole rabbinic career was being one of the founders of a homeless shelter in the Valley. I was one of the founders of something called the Valley Shelter on Lancashire that now is transforming into the largest full service homeless shelter in the country.
Fantastic.
And you know, it's like it's part of my own personal legacy and something I've been proud of. But you know, I didn't do the same thing here on the West Side that I did starting there. And I had an opportunity. I was president of the Board of Rabbis of Southern California for a couple of years, and I remember I had the opportunity to sort of turn that into a very public, to becoming a very public rabbinic figure in Los Angeles, if I wanted to. I had a number of opportunities and requests to do speaking things, different things, and I remembered at the time consciously choosing not to do that, and rather to spend my time focusing here on the community. Corresponding to that was my wife once telling me at about the same time that she thought I was on too many nonprofit boards. I was on like a half a dozen different nonprofit boards, mostly homeless related and things and hunger related, and that it was drawing so much of my time to be involved in all these nonprofit boards that it was causing me a lot of stress personally, because I was feeling torn with all these things and I felt like I needed to make a choice. And so I got off of all of those boards and to refocus on simply KI in Kiel, Israel, which was growing and thriving, and to sort of be the local hometown rabbi. So I have a little bit of push-pull.
Doesn't sound like a whole lot of regrets.
No, I don't have a lot of regrets. I feel blessed in my personal rabbinic career. To me, I'm proud of growing the largest Reconstructionist congregation in the world here at KI.
How many? What was the membership when you started?
It was about 240 families.
Now it's over 1,000.
Now it's 1,000. Yeah. So you know, and that's a lot of growth for any synagogue. And you know, in this, the Reconstruction movement's the smallest movement, but it was exciting to be such a significant force in that, and to have grown a congregation to 1,000 families is, you know, it's a good success, and to have this, the nature of this community, and be able to be a part of it. So
if when you were looking for a full-time gig, the opportunity had come for you to be a rabbi in Los Angeles of a Reform congregation, could you have done that?
Yes, I probably would have. I mean, I grew up in the Reform movement. I was working for the Reform movement, Temple Judea's Reform congregation. But at the same time, my parents were intellectually involved in Reconstructionism. We had the Reconstructionist magazine in our home. We've used the Reconstructionist Haggadah for Passover my whole life. I had Mordecai Kaplan, who was the founder of Reconstructionism, as a teacher in Jerusalem when he was 90. Scary guy, but brilliant.
Scary smart.
Scary smart. And scary. He would yell at everybody. He was this big guy, but brilliant. And so I was always, you know, drawn to the openness of the philosophy, the non-supernaturalism of Reconstructionism, the sense of that what gives Jews our identity is not so much belief, but rather belonging. I liked all of that. So I was happy to come to a Reconstructionist congregation because it fit my own philosophy anyway. But otherwise, I would have gone anywhere where I could have got a pulpit.
And now, you had a question.
Oh, about
I want to know
what I'm doing now.
What are you doing now?
I want to know about the workshops and what you're doing now, because I think that's just incredible, and you should take this time that we have left to talk about
it. Okay. So when I retired as the senior, I'm still not. My wife keeps going, I thought you were retired. This is what retirement looks like. What retirement looks like is I'm still doing things at the synagogue. I did Torah study last week. I do services periodically. I do whatever I'm asked to do when I can. I teach an adult class. I give one sermon on holidays. You know, I'm still sort of have a rabbinic presence there. Because I have all the time of all the things I'm not doing, I decided it was an opportunity to focus on something that had always been an issue with me, which is domestic violence. I know too many people who've had domestic violence experiences. That's why I said I spoke from it on the pulpit decades ago already, because the Jewish community is one of those communities that lives in denial, that it doesn't happen to us, it happens to everybody else. You know, it doesn't, Jewish men don't do that, you know. So
Jewish women don't do that.
Jewish women don't do that, and Jewish men don't do that. Just like they don't, what, drink, do drugs, do any of those other things.
Have affairs.
Any of those things, which of course they do, like everybody else. Yeah. So I decided I would take the opportunity to try to raise the consciousness of the community about the existence of domestic violence in the Jewish community and get synagogues to become consciously safe sanctuaries from domestic violence. So I created this project almost 2 years ago now called Home Shalom. And started creating materials to share with rabbis in different congregations to encourage them to put out resources for people in public about where they could call to get help. I partnered with the Board of Rabbis of Southern California and Jewish Family Service, which has a family violence project, ran a couple of times now, have done workshops for rabbis on the issue of domestic violence. And I partnered with Naomi Ackerman, who is this remarkable actress and founder of another nonprofit called Advot, which means ripples in Hebrew. And together we are presenting, I'm sort of underwriting through Home Shalom, Naomi mostly doing healthy relationship workshops for teens. She does two things. She does this incredible one-woman show called Flowers Aren't Enough, which is sort of the arc of a relationship in, about domestic violence that's very powerful and inspires people to sort of get involved and talk about it, and which we're doing in different synagogues and places. And then we're doing healthy relationship workshops in synagogue youth groups, in general youth groups around town, in day schools, at camps, which I've been doing now for the last couple of years. I'm partnering with the Jewish Federation, their teen wellness program. And, you know, there's a need for, and kids are seem to be loving being involved in them. They're very interactive because Naomi's an actress, so she does sort of almost theater game kind of workshops with them. But learning more about boundaries and learning about what does it mean to be a boy and what does it mean to be a girl and what does it mean to say yes or no to exploring your own sexuality, your own relation, what's a healthy relationship. Also, how are you supposed to treat each other? How do you show respect and personal dignity to someone? What do you do when you're feeling uncomfortable? Who do you go to? So that's been rewarding and exciting and still frustrating because I'm constantly bumping up against It's not really our issue. It's not really our issue from rabbis and other Jewish...
It's really our issue.
And it's really our issue.
It's really an issue.
Yes,
are you dealing mostly with teens?
I'm dealing with adults when we do Flowers Aren't Enough, or adults and teens, and then we have these talkbacks afterwards that talk about the issue. But the workshops are all with teens. So, and I'm projecting to, over this current year, to at least touch another 300 to 400 teens in Los Angeles. I'd like it to be a national program, and I'm also on the Jewish Women International has a domestic violence clergy task force on domestic violence, and I'm a part of that now also. So I'm doing some consulting in a sense nationally with other clergy around the country who are involved in how we can create materials and things that people can use in within the Jewish community, mostly in synagogue life, to address the issues. And how do we reach, it's mostly women still who are the victims, how do we reach women to know that there's a safe place to go within a Jewish context? There's numbers they can call, there's resources. And it's an uphill battle. I think it's being helped, frankly, by all of the notoriety at the moment with the Me Toos and the women who are coming forward about their own experiences of harassment and assault.
Although there's such a big division between, you know, where does sexual harassment end and where does domestic violence begin?
I mean, it's messy. It's not. It's clearly. It is messy. It's not. It's not a black and white, you know, issue. And one of the challenges that we obviously face in that issue is that everything becomes as if it's all equal. You know, every action isn't equal, and it's part of our growth and our evolution of gender roles that we have. In, you know, first of all, the whole gender issue is part of the 21st century's rethinking of
what humanity.
What does it mean to be us? And how do you?
Thank you for your service for doing that.
Now that I have the time, it's great. A passion I have, and so.
You know, one of the things that jumps out at me based upon what you're talking about, because, as you know, as a lawyer, I've been involved in a lot of domestic violence cases, normally representing the accused. And so many of the times, in my experience, it seems that the person who is accused of domestic violence, there's almost always alcohol involved. And oftentimes it's both of them. People who are normally getting along okay, doing well, they start drinking, anger flows to the top, and self-control goes out the window. And it's not just one issue, domestic violence. That's obviously a part of it. But oftentimes you've got alcoholism and drug usage and other things that get involved too.
Yeah, well, it's also, violence in the in a broader sense, that is, really I'm dealing with a domestic abuse. And abuse comes in many forms, only one of which is physical violence.
Mm-hmm. True.
There's a whole range of because abuse is about power and control.
Belittling,
so,
humiliation.
You know, it's the humiliation, it's emotional abuse, it's verbal abuse, it's sexual abuse, it's financial abuse. I mean, when you look at the range of what control issues are, and with kids part today, now that, you know, with social media and telephones and texting, part of the one of the ways with young people that domestic abuse, that abuse happens and control happens, is through stalking, you know, text stalking. It's like, I'm showing you I love you by always wanting to know where you are, what you're doing, who you're talking with, you know, constantly being texted, well, who are you talking, what are you doing, because it's about control. So it's a whole new sort of world of how,
rules
of, you know, engagement, of rules of where boundaries are.
I was thinking the other day that somebody, maybe you, should write a new etiquette book.
Yeah.
You know. It's really not polite to ask a girl 15 times in a row within 20 minutes where she is.
Right. Well, it's,
or the other way around.
It's control.
It's a control issue. It's a power and control issue. Yeah. So, you know, so a lot of what we're dealing with isn't physical abuse. It's other kinds of control, and other kinds of infringement on the space, the personal space and dignity of an individual by another. That doesn't have to be their physical presence. And when I talk to lots of the abused people and women in the Jewish community, it's been not physical, but every other version of it. I mean, there's also physical.
I mean, honestly, I think I'd rather be slapped than debased verbally.
Humiliated and embarrassed.
At least you can
shamed
walk away from that legitimately.
Yeah.
But like this little girl in Yucaipa who was bullied, whose dad just had to pull the plug on her yesterday, who was brain dead and tried to commit suicide because she was so bullied at school. And, you know, so much of it is social media bullying where, you know, no hand is being laid on anybody.
Listen, how many of those kids who ended up walking into schools with guns, almost every single one has a background of being humiliated, being bullied, being, you know, the outsider, being pushed out, and finally went, okay, you're not going to ignore me now. You're not going to treat me now and walk in with some gun and start shooting someone in a school.
Right.
Somehow related to that whole bullying.
Jodi Picoult wrote this great book called 19 Minutes, in which she talks about a shooter, a teenage shooter, who she goes back and looks at what happened to him. It's a novel, but that he'd been bullied and pushed around. Parents had humiliated him. Everybody had. And by the end, you almost feel sorry for the shooter because of what he's had to go through.
Look at Manson.
Do we have to?
Well, I mean, you take a four-year-old kid and let him watch his mother being hauled off to jail and being raised by nobody that cared. I mean, bad is bad, but I believe that children are, I don't believe in original sin.
I think
babies come out.
Right. Yeah. Everybody starts, I mean, it's a rare person who's just got some kind of mental issue from birth that sets them that way. But, you know, what we do with people, how we treat them, how we, the neglect and abuse in our society is rampant, you know. And look at, same thing can be said about people incarcerated. When you do studies of people who are incarcerated for violent crime, it's like a humongous percentage of them were in the foster care system, started out, you know, were the castaways
or
of
parents were drug addicts.
Yeah, and they castaways of society.
Just they never had a chance.
We're creating it ourselves. So,
yep.
You know, it's part of...
On that happy note.
Yes, well.
And, well, yeah. Well, one thing I know for sure is that... Rabbi Stephen Carr Rubin, you will continue to fight the fight and
I will.
Be open and tolerant to new ideas and do your best to make this a better place as you have for your whole career.
Thank you.
Amen.
Thanks for joining us. It's
My
been
pleasure.
A pleasure.
Thanks.
We know the joy of giving is its own reward. But who says you can't get something for yourself, too? Now when you buy Vanilla MasterCard gift cards, you can enter to win one of over 10 prizes every week for 10 weeks, including a grand prize of $10,000 in Vanilla gift cards. So, get gifting and start sharing the delight for more chances to win. Go to get-gifting.com to learn more and enter for your chance to win. Cards are issued by the Bancorp Bank and MetaBank, members FDIC, pursuant to license by MasterCard International Incorporated, and may be used in the U.S. everywhere debit MasterCard is accepted. Terms and conditions apply. Cards distributed and serviced by Incom Financial Services, Inc., which is licensed as a money transmitter by the New York State Department of Financial Services, and MLS ID number 912772.